This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. When Vivian Connell was in college, she was already a teacher's advocate. She was on CNN in the network's early years to talk about a teacher's wrongful termination at the University of Georgia. But she wanted more people to hear her voice. When Vivian became a teacher, she amplified it through her students. They advocated for land conservancies and against genocide in Africa, but she wanted an even bigger megaphone. Vivian decided to go back to school for a law degree to become an effective lobbyist for public education. Then the most powerful people in North Carolina would finally hear her. And when Vivian Connell was diagnosed with ALS last year, she had come to terms, and she must have had to come to terms, with the idea that her voice would soon be silent. But along the way, she had inspired so many people that they started speaking for her. National education analyst Diane Ravitch told Vivian's story on her blog. Donations started to pour in for her classes, and she became an advocate for teachers across the state. Her voice is stronger than ever. Vivian Connell is a teacher at Phoenix Academy High School in Chapel Hill, and she joins me now on the State of Things. Vivian, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor.
You were born in rural Georgia, spent some of your early years in Mississippi, right? Tell us about those early years in the Deep South.
Oh, goodness. Well, I was born in Macon. Each of my parents came from very hardworking but poor but proud stock out in Montgomery County and Oak Park and Soperton and a lot of other small towns that most people haven't heard of. And my dad worked for Belk's. He was a manager. And so we traveled around a lot. And my mom was tired of those retail hours. And so we went into textiles, which took us to Mississippi, where I went to elementary school, first through sixth grade. And the years we spent in Crystal Springs were tough. That was those were integration years. And we were quite unhappy. The only choice my parents felt for me was to put me in the white flight school. The public schools had been largely abandoned. And so what I really remember of my childhood was that sort of unhappiness with all that racial tension in Mississippi. And we were so glad when in middle school when we made it to Greenville, South Carolina, which to me was like the big city. Mm. And where I did middle school and high school.
But you had to come home and ask your parents what that nasty little grammar school chant
I did.
Meant, right?
I did. My parents had always told me that you treat everyone the same. And I was raised in a good old Baptist church, red and yellow, black and white. They are all precious in His sight. And I came home and asked my mom in third grade, what did 2, 4, 6, 8, we don't want to intragrate. I didn't even know the word mean. And I remember my mom started to cry. So we were all really very unhappy with that situation. It was a tough time to be in Mississippi when you weren't a Mississippian and when you weren't a part of that resistance to change.
And even though they grew up in the South, they were uncomfortable with the level of bigotry that
they
found there. And yet you describe them as fairly conservative in their outlook, by and large.
Well, yes, very much so. They did not have friends who were people of color. They did not have the opportunity to go to college, but they were determined that I would. And so that was always a goal for them. I don't think they realized how much education would separate me from their own cultural and political values.
You went to the University of Georgia.
I did.
Took photography there, and I understand that it was photography, perhaps, that may have changed your life.
It was. I mean, I went because I wanted to be a vet. They had a vet school. That was the only reason. My parents, who were very working class, were willing to send me out of state. That was a real stretch on their resources. And when I got there, I discovered that I was much more inspired by literature classes. And I saw a lot of exciting music and art and progressive culture around me. And so I did. I took an art photography class, a pinhole camera class. And I started doing photojournalism photography at the University of Georgia newspaper, The Red and Black. And that really sort of opened a lot of doors for me. And I started going to a lot of different events and lectures. And especially I photographed a lot of progressive bands. And I was really drawn into that world of that was very different from the world I'd grown up in.
An REM concert in particular may have had.
Oh, an REM concert, The Replacements. There were a lot of bands at the time. Of course, REM was local, and the B-52s had come from Athens. And so it was a really exciting time to to be in Athens. There were so many people, so many good clubs, and so many good bands came there. And there was a lot of progressive thought around that. You know what I mean? In that culture, it was expected that you would have independent ideas and follow your own thoughts. And there was a lot of divergent thinking and a lot of challenging of the status quo that drew me. And where I'd grown up in Greenville, South Carolina, it was play along to get along, mm-hmm. do your best, compete, try to, you know, make the best grades you can. It was about fitting in. Whereas this culture was, I won't say it was about standing out, but it was definitely about holding to your convictions and expressing those through art, music, or advocacy.
So you're having a real awakening. Again, there is this intellectual environment. It allows an artistic environment.
Yes.
You're awakening. You're encouraged to be independent. And yet, it was the University of Georgia, and you talked about first of all, let's talk about the teacher who was fired at the University of Georgia.
Yes, I remember that. I was knee-deep in progressive culture, and it sort of rejected the mainstream culture that I had started out in. And I was called to do an assignment to cover the SACC, Students Against Campus Corruption, which was a group that had formed around a lawsuit. A woman, Jan Kemp, had been terminated for refusing to change athletes' grades. This is, of course, timely in this area right now. And she brought a lawsuit, and she was successful. And so I ended up joining the Students Against Campus Corruption after covering them and photographing them, and was part of a rally I'll never forget on North Campus that was covered by CNN, where we call for the resignation of those involved. And it was an energizing experience.
And not everything on the campus was progressive. You talked about a particular fraternity event that you found troubling.
That really stuck with me. Most of my friends, I would say, from high school were anxious to go to college and join fraternities and sororities, and many of them did and are wonderful people. I certainly don't judge all by the few, but the Kappa Alpha chapter at Georgia had an Old South parade, and the brothers would go into the low-income housing that abutted the back of campus, and they would pay young African-American boys, I don't know, 50 cents a dollar, some real token price, to dress up like slave children and walk in their parades. And I was really horrified.
We are meeting Vivian Connell today on The State of Things. Vivian Connell was recently diagnosed with ALS, and I should say that you're in a wheelchair now. You may even hear the little beep periodically that comes from it, which is perfectly all right. I just thought I would explain it for our audience.
Sure.
But that sound is fine. It just explains what's going on. But there is now a divide that you find growing between your political values and your parents' values.
There was. My parents were always supportive and wanted to be supportive, but they saw education as a means of gaining economic security, right? Not so much of broadening perspectives or a doorway to experience or, you know, helping to discover how to live an authentic and meaningful life, which was, of course, what I loved about education. So my parents, again, super supportive, have moved here to support me, kind and wonderful people. But they did not attend my law school graduation, and my father did say to me, we just don't know where you've acquired your liberalism. So, you know, God bless them. We love each other, but we don't always understand each other.
You talked about going to law school. Before that, you became a teacher. What was the impetus?
I did. You know, it was funny. When I was in Athens, I was going to do something, I don't know, art, music. I wanted to do something so profound, but I loved literature. And a couple of years later, I did some student teaching, and I felt called. I mean, I knew that the classroom was where I belonged. And so I started teaching in Savannah, Georgia in 1989, and then went to Japan for 2 years. And that was a wonderful time that really cemented for me the idea that I was a call teacher, and that's what I was meant to do. When I came back from Japan in 91, I had done some language training. And so I was hired at Furman as a Furman Advantage Fellow. I co-taught Japanese there and got my master's in English and my full teaching certification. And after that, I'd been about 5 years in the classroom. And so I spent the next 15 teaching ESL, English, and Japanese, but primarily English. And then the last few years in Charlotte before we moved to Chapel Hill in 2010 were spent doing a lot of coaching students towards civic engagement and advocacy.
We'll talk more about that. The training in Japanese, of course, the fact that you were fluent allowed you also to be an interpreter during the Atlanta Olympics, right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of those examples. You know, my parents were terrified for me to go and live abroad. They said, well, goodness, if you're going to be a teacher, you need to get going on your retirement and get vested and start saving. And going as a single girl across to Japan, I remember my mother was terrified. What if you get over there and you can't get back? And I remember saying, Mom, that's China. It was a wonderful experience that they were very afraid for me to have. But it did absolutely shape my life. And so when I came back and I was teaching high school, I was able to be a venue language services manager. And I met some lifelong friends there, including my husband.
More on that when we continue today. We're talking this hour with North Carolina teacher Vivian Connell, and we will hear more about her advocacy and her work in public education on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. My guest this hour is Vivian Connell. She's a teacher and a teacher's advocate in North Carolina, and talking about finding a voice. You felt called to be a teacher,
yes,
but you also clearly had some very serious ideas about social justice. Were they mingled? Did you have a sense? Was there any tension between advocacy work and classroom work for you?
Actually, Frank, it was a course that really sort of enabled me to blend the two. When I went back to teaching full time after my children were in full day preschool and school, my principal at Providence High, I'll never forget, she said, well, which courses do you feel most comfortable with? I said, American Lit. That's juniors. I've also taught a lot of British. I'd love seniors. And I've even done ninth grade, which ensured that I would get 10th, the only prep I had never taught, which was world literature. And it became my favorite course to teach. And so we had just gotten new books in CMS with a textbook purchase, The Bookseller of Kabul, which forced me to do a lot of research on Afghanistan. This was post 9/11, post Northern Alliance invasion, where we had removed the Taliban. And I ended up teaching that and then talking about the different religions and their formation and religious texts, Siddhartha and the quest for self. And then we did a lot of books on, we talked about conflict in World War I, and then we taught Elie Wiesel's Night, Holocaust studies, bringing up tolerance and justice and what happens when good people do nothing. And finally, I taught about the dirty war in Argentina through a book called Imagining Argentina and about colonialism and minority rule under apartheid with Cry the Beloved Country. And so it was all these works that generated the issues. And I'll never forget the very first year I taught the course, I brought in someone to talk about women in Afghanistan and the oppression they faced under the Taliban. And my students, when they heard about women with uncovered faces being splashed with acid and the abject poverty, they said, what can we do? What can we do? We want to do something. And it was actually their voice talking to me that led to the formation of Voices Activated, a student advocacy club that really inspired me to eventually leave the classroom so that I could become more civically engaged, not only on education policy, but other issues of social justice.
You said CMS. This is Charlotte Mecklenburg. Were you there?
We were, yes. Yeah. We were in Charlotte at the time.
And so what, and just to, I want to take you now as you take this next step to advocacy, but I'm wondering what these students were coming up with. What do they think they could do? What did they do?
Well, we sort of rallied around the very famous Margaret Mead quote that, you know, never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has. And I certainly believed that they could. They were interested in international issues, the plight of women, genocide. The first thing we did was we had a filmmaker come. Her name was Charmin Obey Chinoy. And she gave a lecture about how one voice can change the world. And what she had done through filmmaking and education about the plight of women under theocratic Islamic rule. And she had also just done a film about the children who were victims of the invasion of Iraq. We showed that film. The kids raised money, sent a ton to Doctors Without Borders, and they were energized. They said, this is great. So she inspired them, and then they inspired each other. They said, we're going to take on something else next. And there were kids who were very passionate about environmental issues. There were those who were concerned about refugees and genocide, and then those who were concerned more about local issues of equity. You know, the idea that almost everyone from Providence High, one of the highest performing schools, would go on to college and have a great deal of success, whereas in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools, there were quote-unquote failing schools where kids did not have resources and were not succeeding. And they thought that any school that wasn't good enough for every kid shouldn't have to be good enough for somebody else's kid. And so all of those issues were wrapped up, and they would choose an issue, and then we would do some education, put up some flyers, and then they would have an event. And really, students ran it, and it was the greatest experience of my teaching career.
Yeah, of course, and you forever opened their eyes to the possibility of not only what they can do, but remaining alert to all of those injustices and not allowing yourself to go to sleep when it's right in your midst.
They're out there doing great work.
When you took your own advice to heart when you took on the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system, they were about to shut down all their magnet schools.
Well, I was asked if I could speak. They were going to do away with the magnet program, including the magnet at my son's elementary school. That didn't affect us because it was our local school. We were there anyway. But there were many families who had brought their kids to the school when it was under-enrolled, and they had done so being promised that their siblings would be grandfathered in. And, they were going to pull the program and then send all of those kids who had been wrapped up in these magnet communities since they were in, they were in strollers and their big brothers and sisters were attending there. I remember one, Henry was in third grade, going to send him back to his local school with no knowledge of that community, no friends and no support there. And that was the first time I had sort of done independent lobbying. Had a wonderful school board member named Trent Merchant, who I had been to a couple of his events, and he gave me his ear. And I convinced him, and that was so incredibly empowering. I was so pleased that I was able to contribute, and I thought, my goodness, I would really love to continue to do that, but you can't really be civically engaged and highly active and be a good high school teacher. It's a 50 to 60 hour a week job. So
you didn't flip just him, but then ultimately the board did decide.
Yes, the board was looking at a 7-2 defeat, and it was an 8-1 victory by the end of the night. So yeah, it was terrific.
As you said, you decided that maybe focusing on advocacy would be the way to go. You went to law school then, is that right?
I did. Initially, I was concerned about education policy and the way that that was going, what we call corporate-based reform, an increase in testing, tighter regimens as far as not letting teachers control their curriculum. And I decided that rather than telling my students every year, well, we have to do this because they say we have to, and maybe that someone will tell them that they shouldn't, that, I was 46. I thought, well, I'll be done before I'm 50. I'll have a 15 or 20-year career. And I should do this. I should walk the walk, not just talk the talk.
You did decide to go to law school.
I did.
But you changed your mind there. You decided to switch from education advocacy to consumer advocacy.
Eventually, I did. I did not take education law. The thing about education is I'm almost too close to it. There are situations where I really empathize with the teachers, others where I empathize with the school boards, and others where I empathize with families and parents. And I did not want to have to pick a constituency, if that makes sense, although I definitely was anti-corporate-based reforms, privatization, and pro-public schools. I definitely agree with the North Carolina Constitution's mandate that every child should have access to a sound, free public education. But yeah, I actually, before I was diagnosed, I started a blog called Teacher, Lawyer, Kill Me. And the tagline said, I came to law school upset about education policy. Now I'm upset about a lot more things. You know, many other issues.
It doesn't take long to see the connection. I mean, if you systematically through your policies starve certain neighborhoods and don't allow arteries of capital to move through, and if we find that, you know, people in those neighborhoods are disproportionately sent to jail,
yes,
you're going to find that the schools there are poor, and then you're going to come up with a commodified. There is a commodified solution to this. We will sell you a product. So the American.
Correct.
We'll sell you a product that'll fix your problem, which, by the way, we caused through our indifference.
Absolutely.
And in fact,
we're
going to
sell it
school.
To
it's
you, but
school.
We have absolutely no research to indicate that it's going to work. So, yeah, that was sort of a disaster. And so my 3L year, I was a member of the Consumer Financial Transactions Clinic, and I defended indigent individuals in foreclosures. And this is at a time when many foreclosures were happening illegally. And it was a real pleasure to be a part of that clinic. And I saw underserved people without access to justice and to legal services. And so by the time I graduated, I was very interested in doing consumer protection law or working with one of the wonderful public interest firms in the state, like the North Carolina Justice Center. Of course, they have the Education Project as well. They serve, they do multiple issues, which is terrific. Pisgah Legal Services, Legal Aid, Southern Coalition for Social Justice in Durham. So many lawyers who, quite frankly, defy the stereotype and are doing great work that so desperately needs to be done.
And it's getting harder and harder for them to do their work just because of the financial pinch.
Oh, my goodness. Well, from the crash, and then there have been several major decisions, as I'm sure you and much of our audience know, at the Supreme Court level that have made it harder to get class action certified and much easier for corporations to insulate themselves against liability. I was looking at the Alliance for Justice website, and they said the worst case, other than Citizens United, which of course allows unlimited campaign contributions, and that has caused quite a firestorm in our state and across the nation as far as the power of a few to impact our democratic elections. But the other one is a case called Concepcion. And I became really wrapped up in this my 1L year when I learned that because of Concepcion, many students who were defrauded by for-profit colleges and universities could not get into court because when they had been given the hard sell, there was an arbitration agreement in their contract, in their enrollment contract. Before Concepcion, there was a lawyer at Public Justice who had done some great work, and the state could say, you know what? If you don't let these people arbitrate as a class, that's unconscionable, and they would strike down the arbitration agreement so that people could go forward as a class. Unfortunately, Concepcion said, nope, all arbitration agreements will be enforced as written. And that had infuriated me, and I had done some research on that my senior year and had been assisted by one of the attorneys at Public Justice. And so that was another issue that I came out really hoping to do some work to change.
Well, you went to law school in 2010. Last year, 2014, you were diagnosed with ALS.
Yes. And as you said, I was teaching at the time. I had been really gratified to be offered a clerkship by a judge I adore on the North Carolina Supreme Court, a really wise and wonderful jurist. But because of my health issues, I was not ready to embark on a legal career, and I was doing ESL support teaching at Phoenix and at Chapel Hill High.
Phoenix, describe just briefly, if I may interrupt.
Sure,
describe Phoenix for us and the what
Phoenix,
that school is.
John Williams, the principal, has done a wonderful thing. So has all the people who support it at Chapel Hill, Carbery City Schools. It takes kids who really cannot succeed for a variety of reasons in that large high school traditional environment. And it gives them very small classes, a lot of support, and they are graduating more and more kids. They're just doing beautiful work. Most of the kids that are there, though, are children of color. They face all kinds of obstacles. Some are early parents. I've never seen such dedicated parents working hard to succeed so that they can provide a better life for their kids. Some of them have learning disabilities that aren't addressed well at the larger schools. And some of them have behavioral and anger issues, but not all of those issues are unjustified. And so they come to Phoenix and they're given wonderful attention. And I really loved it. You hear alternative school and you think bad kids, and that's just not the case.
So there you were, and then you get the diagnosis.
Yes, I got the diagnosis in March. By that time, I had been through so many specialists up until December, I was not really surprised, Frank, but I knew that I would not have that legal career. And so then it was a matter of how do I react to this with grace? How do I make the most of the time that I have left? What do I model for my kids and for my students now? And so I've tried, you know, very hard not to let ALS take away my voice or change me, but to keep advocating for the things I believed in. And as you said, I was able to do as an advisory board member of Public Schools First NC, and as a sort of independent spokesperson, I was able to do a lot of speech making and write some letters to the editor. And really fortunate to do I was the spokesperson in a $3 million ad buy from the NEA during the Tillis and Hagen campaign, and it was a thrill to be able to serve those causes.
So tell us about the initial symptoms. When did you start noticing?
You know, when I was studying for the bar, I noticed that my left leg was weak. I couldn't hop on it, and I was tripping a little bit, and I honestly thought it might be stress. It was funny, when I talked about final exams, some of the kids a year ahead of me wrote me and said, "You think you're stressed by exams, just wait till you have to take the bar. It's a nightmare." I'd hoped that that was it, but my leg got weaker and weaker. I had what they call foot drop. I could not lift my left foot. And after several CT scans had ruled out any sort of spinal impingement or MS, there was no demyelination in the brain or on the spine, the initial doctor said, "It's undiagnosable. We don't know what you have, but we can't help you."
I am talking to Vivian Connell today on The State of Things. She teaches English as a second language at Phoenix Academy High School in Chapel Hill. And she's talking today about her diagnosis. And that is one of the characteristics of ALS. You really can't diagnose. There's no test for it. So you have to rule out.
That's correct. It is a diagnosis by omission. You have to rule out everything else first.
So you did. So you were coming to that. When did you first realize that this was a possibility for you, that it was, there could be
ALS? ALS?
Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Well, my husband says I tend to see the glass half full, but I had sort of thought, oh, my God, I bet I have ALS. That would just be perfect after coming to law school and passing the bar. That would be my luck. It was actually in my post-bar trip with my best friend to Charleston. We had a girls' weekend, and she's a physical therapist. And I was I was never very athletic, but I was a walker and a runner. We had taken a 5-mile power walk on the beach, and she said, "You're favoring that leg. Something's wrong with your gait." She said, "Let me look at it." And she was very, very adamant. "Listen, I don't have the physical therapist don't diagnose. I can't diagnose you." But when she looked at my leg, I could tell she was very concerned. And she said, "You have whole leg weakness. This isn't just your ankle or just your knee." And I said, "Yeah." She said, "And you're hyperreflexive." And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, that's a red flag to systemic things." And I said, "Well, what could it be?" She said, "I do not know." She said, "But you need to see a neurologist." I said, "What's the worst case scenario?" She said, "Well, the worst case scenario is ALS, but you don't have ALS. That's super rare." But from that day, I started looking up things online, and all the symptoms fit. And
what do we know about ALS?
Well, we know that gradually your motor neurons die, and we don't know why it starts. There's I think 15% of patients have familial ALS, and so there's a gene they can actually identify. But for the vast majority of us, they do not know what causes it. And your symptoms can start with your swallowing, eating, speaking. Those are bulbar symptoms. They can start in the extremities, in the hands. Some people can't button. They notice hand weakness. For me, it was the lower extremities in the foot. And gradually, your motor neurons shut down, and more of you becomes paralyzed, and then eventually you cannot breathe.
On the State of Things today, I'm talking to Vivian Connell. She teaches English as a second language at Phoenix Academy. She's been diagnosed with ALS. She blogs about it. She talks about it. She has come to terms with her diagnosis, and we'll talk more about it today on the State of Things when we return. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking this hour with North Carolina teacher and teacher's advocate Vivian Connell. Before the break, we were talking about your diagnosis, ALS, and it almost had an immediate impact. You had to turn down a clerkship, did you know?
Well, actually, I had turned down the clerkship before I knew I had ALS because I knew it might be ALS or MS, and that I was going to have to figure out how to manage my health before I embarked on a legal career. I knew that it would be long days, and whatever job I took as an entry-level job in the legal world would require really a full-time commitment. So I didn't want to take something that I couldn't do well.
What was the other, I mean, initially when you finally did get the diagnosis, as you said, you'd been coming to this on your own.
Yes.
When you finally heard, what happened?
Well, I think first of all, the hardest thing was to see my husband receive the news on that day and then to have to tell our children. I think it's much harder when you're being left behind. Any parent knows you would rather have ALS than watch your children have ALS. You would rather, as I refer to it, have an early exit than for someone you love to have an early exit. Then you're left behind with the grief and the pain. And so that was very hard. But for me, I have to be honest, Frank, think about my background. Think about what I came from. My mom's never been on an airplane. They've never traveled abroad. They didn't have the opportunity to go to college from their rural high school upbringing. All I thought about was, my gosh, I'm so lucky. I've lived abroad. I've swum in the phosphorescent sea of Thailand. I've learned another language. I got to, have a job at the Olympics. I've had these years of wonderful students in my classroom. I really felt that my life at age 51 had been extraordinary and more than anyone could ask for. And so it would be really unseemly to be angry. I mean, if somebody has to have ALS, why not me? And one of the first people I heard about it who had it other than myself, a friend said, one of my high school friends was just diagnosed. He's a professor of economics at South Carolina. He was 36, and his children were 4 and 2 at the time he was diagnosed. My kids are 15 and 13. We have a chance to build memories, and they will remember me. And so, I don't know. I wanted to be gracious. I wanted to be more grateful than anything. I wanted to give credit to my faith. And so, am I sad for the loss? Of course. I will also say, though, that so much good has come through support and, I think, undeserved recognition from people that I've been too busy trying to carry on with good things to worry about or complain, if that makes any sense.
It does. What's your prognosis?
Well, they usually say 2 to 3 years. My progression looks to be normal, not slow, which would put me on that 2 to 3 year track, and I'm a year in. So I can still walk a little bit with a walker, and I'm getting some breathing assistance at night. But as you hear, I can still speak. I can still eat. I'm not on a feeding tube. I can still use my hands and type. And so the general prognosis is that I will probably be unable to breathe in about 18 months to 2 years. And how that goes and what order things fail in is a mystery. Also, I could plateau today and live for 20 years. That's one of the frustrating things about ALS is it's very hard to give anyone a prognosis. Everyone's different, and so it's hard to plan. But as I've told people, I'm definitely available to live longer. I'm available for a cure. I'm available for a treatment. But I figure that if I plan for the worst case scenario and put my affairs in order and do what I ought to do, that extra time is a bonus.
I suppose the other thing that we have to admire you for is the fact that these are motor neurons that go. And so you remain corpus mentis this whole time as the ability for your muscles to work fails.
Yes. I think that that's both a comfort to know that you will keep your wits about you the whole time, but it's also in a way a curse when you have an active mind and you can no longer communicate, no longer move at all, no longer speak. In general, ALS patients retain their eye movement, which is how Stephen Hawking and others are able to communicate on a screen that registers eye movement. And so, you know, if I get to that point and I can still contribute to my family through my eye movement and communication, I hope that I will have the courage to continue on. And, you know, if I can't, I'm ready to go. As a person of faith, I really do think there are many worse things worse than death.
Well, and you said you have come to this, and for you the hardest part was communicating this to your family, and then
yes.
The next step would be communicating this to your friends.
Yes.
Which brings us to Facebook.
Does it really? Yes, it does. That was my Monty story. Of course, I emailed and called my closest friends, and we had told our family, but I was blessed with what I felt was a very rich community of friends. I had new national education friends. I had been in Austin the week before my diagnosis with the Network for Public Education, meeting Diane Ravitch and a part of, you know, education policy leaders. It had been a thrill. Before that, I'd been in law school, so I had classmates and professors. I had been working with policy advocates in North Carolina on a variety of issues. I had good friends there, people who had been doing informational interviews, trying to guide me toward what legal career I was going to have. I had my wonderful students and colleagues at Phoenix High and Chapel Hill High, and those kids. And then, of course, I had old friends, and most particularly, a big chunk of my Facebook friends are my former students, with whom I love keeping in touch, who are out there doing wonderful things and making me very proud. And so I did not want to have the conversation 200 or 300 times. And I wanted the information out there to be correct. I didn't want to tell one person, and then they go to orally, you know, the game you play where you whisper and things change. I wanted all the information to be accurate. And so I decided to announce it on Facebook, and I did what was a private Facebook post. I know you're laughing.
I'm laughing out loud.
I couldn't imagine that anyone outside my circle of friends would be interested, to tell you the truth. But, you know, I stressed these are the facts, and there is no cure. Please don't tell me to go drink coconut oil and, you know, go look, you know, go to Mexico for, or there is no cure. I want to accept this and do what I can, and I'm okay. And I also wanted to, I did in the post give people ways that they could feel empowered. You know, you can like this and share it. Make sure everybody knows. You can, if you want to talk about it, message me privately so that my Facebook feed does not become the ALS channel. I did not want all ALS all the time. And then I said you can support campaign finance reform, the Network for Public Education. And then I mentioned they could help me with a field trip. And that's when things got very interesting. I had already been trying to find means to take our Phoenix High kids not to the Holocaust Museum in Richmond, which I'm sure is lovely. But as I said at the Monty, these kids get off-brand everything. I was like, you know, we can go the extra hour and a half to D.C.
Well, if I may interrupt you there,
oh, please.
Flip that for a second, because what I think, if I understand the order of operations, you suggested that they go to the Holocaust
yes.
Museum in Washington, and they said, oh, no, we can't take these kids.
Well,
too
they
much
did.
Trouble.
They said, well, it wasn't like that. The people at Phoenix love the kids, but it was, no, we've never done that. Mm. That's not the plan. We don't have the money. We don't have the resources. We haven't gone down that road. And I went to the principal and said, if I can find the money, he said, if you can find the money, yes, I will do that. And then once I was diagnosed, the whole staff really wanted to do it for me because they knew it was important to me. It sort of felt like my last act as a teacher. And I wanted to take the Karen refugee kids from Chapel Hill High who had experienced ethnic persecution and genocide in Myanmar. And it came together beautifully. Not because of my private Facebook post, but because one of my education advocacy friends cut and pasted it and sent it to Diane Ravitch, who blogged it to, you know, over 100,000 people. And as I said at the Monty, I lost control of the story then, which had not been my intent. But someone said to me when that happened, I was really sort of mortified, grateful for the attention and support, but mortified. I'm not the go-tell Oprah type. And she said, you know, Vivian, ALS is going to use you. So you should find ways to use ALS.
And you did, because this is March and you want to go to the Holocaust Museum in May.
Yes.
And that's something else you should know about.
yes, absolutely. You mean about the tickets?
About getting tickets to the Holocaust Museum,
oh,
2 months
goodness.
Away.
Well, yeah. Right before, well, first of all, when she blogged to Diane Ravitch, and I posted on Saturday night, Sunday morning, everything blew up. I came out, I looked at my phone, and I thought, how can I have that many notifications and that many emails? I would say over half of them were, where do we donate to this trip? And I thought, goodness, I better get that page up and running. And so we did that very quickly. Dr. Yvonne Brannon and the Foundation for North Carolina Foundation for Public School Children acted as my fiscal agent. They were incredibly supportive and helpful. And right before I hit, let's go live, it occurred to me, I should probably make sure I could get tickets. Because as I said at the Monty, in the world of student educational travel to D.C., a ticket to the Holocaust Museum is like the Duke UNC ticket. You plan in advance. You certainly don't call them in March to go in May. But I did. And they said, we don't have anything. And initially I thought, oh, my God, how am I going to walk this back? But then my friend encouraged me, you know, tell them your story. And I did. I told them that I had been a teaching fellow at the museum a couple of summers before, that I had done Holocaust studies for several years, and that I was now dying, and that next year was not an option for me. And so, bless them, they found tickets and resources, and it turned out to be my kids had a day. Those kids had a day at the museum, and so did I, that was unprecedented. They had never used their docent guides for students before. Those guides are generally reserved for VIPs and heads of state. And they took our kids in small groups and ushered them, parted the Red Sea. The museum was crowded. excuse us, coming through. And they ushered my kids right to the front and gave them an experience that I have every faith, every belief. You know, it'll change their lives, I'm sure.
That's what you went to D.C. for. And then you had an unexpected trip and got to visit the National Archives before you went to the Holocaust Museum.
Yes, I was tweeted by David Ferriero, who is our 10th National Archivist. And David said, why not bring these kids to archives? And I thought, how do you know about this? Who are you and what's going on? David used to be the director of all the Duke libraries and had seen the story. And he said, a lot of people don't know, we have Holocaust-related documents. And I said, goodness, it's so crowded at archives. I'm worried about the time. We have a very short. And so he said, we'll open early for you.
I'm talking to Vivian Connell today on The State of Things. She's talking about her diagnosis of ALS, her advocacy for children, public education. So you get the okay, you get the green light,
yes.
And what happened next?
Well, so many people to mention, not enough time here. First of all, friends were incredibly supportive, but you wouldn't believe the strangers we heard from. A wine owner in Napa who insisted on being anonymous said, go ahead and book the trip. Don't worry about being fully funded. Whatever you don't raise, I'll pay for it.
In the National Archives, then you got kind of the cook's tour because you got there.
Oh my goodness!
You opened before
they
you got opened there before
at
it
eight.
Opened.
They had us in, and it was kind of wonderful because my kids, who can be really rambunctious and playful and irreverent, were so solemn. They were being led down a private corridor, like in National Treasure, you know. And we go into a room, and they've laid out the actual Nuremberg Laws.
Wow.
That they've studied about, of course. We've prepped them very well. And then they bring out the art lookbooks, the big volumes that the Nazis made with pictures of the art they had appropriated, stolen, all over Europe. And they made these books to show to Hitler and Goering and so that they could pick and choose for their private collections. And, of course, these books were in Monuments Men, the George Clooney film.
Right, right.
And so my kids were able to go right up to these documents, people with white gloves holding them and turning the pages, and it was fabulous. Then they got 45 minutes alone in the rotunda with the founding documents and people there to answer their questions, and they were They were mesmerized, so excited.
I have to take you quickly now to the Holocaust Museum and the end, one student who bought a yellow star.
Oh, the Star of David. Yeah, that was unbelievable. They were so solemn in the museum. It was a beautiful trip. And we finish, and the kid comes out, and he's hanging a Star of David around his neck, an African-American young man. And I honestly didn't know, and I said, wait, Caleb, are you Jewish? And he said, no, Miss Connell, but I am never taking this off. He goes, I had no idea. And, you know, the idea of the kids said, we will always speak up. This isn't just about, we had illegal kids there who were Hispanic, a lot of African-American kids. And so they saw that it's not just people of color, that any time we otherize, that we take a minority group of people, treat them as the other, and begin to discriminate against them, that that is a great evil. And so, yes, He's, according to him, still wearing that Star of David today.
Well, and I think here is, and even if it seems not direct, I think it's quite direct, the lesson and one of the ways in which we can hold you as a model, when you embrace your own suffering as your own, and this is easy for me to say because I'm not facing what you do, there is a way in which we can internalize and process. If we don't, if we look for pleasure and run away from pain, then we'll project. And that's what happens in a pogrom. You take your anxiety and you project it onto someone else, which is probably why good people can remain silent in the face of horror. They're projecting their pain onto someone else. So I think there, if you don't mind, is the example that we can draw from you. And for those left behind struggling with how we will manage the grief, that seems to me to be the legacy lesson from you, and we deeply appreciate it. And before I say goodbye, I want to point out that there's going to be a benefit performance. REM's going to be there, right?
Oh, no. The band is no longer operating as the band.
I thought maybe they're going to come together just
Once. Well, but they're
the documentary.
The documentary, REM by MTV. Their advisor, Bertis Downs, longtime lawyer and friend of mine, who's now active in education policy, they are gifting me a showing of that film as a benefit. They had always been in great support of public interest law from their early days. And so this is going to benefit public justice as they fight for the environment, civil rights, and the little guy.
Public Justice Foundation benefit performance, Cat's Cradle, Carrboro, April 10th.
Yes.
The documentary on REM will be there. Vivian Connell will be there as well.
And the pop-up chorus.
And the pop-up chorus. Vivian, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful.
All this information at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.